You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. All right, so here's a thought. Let's make the labor market boring again. How about that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 8th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We will talk, as we are going today, about making the labor market boring again. But the conversation will be anything but boring. So much to talk about, so little time. It's a one-woman show today. Kate Davidson is solo. She's at Bloomberg. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. What do you think? Is the labor market, can we just say that the labor market is kind of getting boring again?
Yeah, I was remembering, I think I was on your show some years ago and uttered the words, another strong jobs report, blah, 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 I think is what I said. And it sort of feels like that again, right? Like, still chugging along.
Super important, obviously. But look, this is a no net effect jobs report on the Fed for next week, right? And it's very calm. So this is a good thing that the labor market's getting boring again, right?
For sure. Yes. Okay. I mean, you know, all kidding aside, it was a strong report, and it is what I think Fed officials want to see, right? It will kind of keep them in their current posture, which is, mm-hmm. look, we have room to be patient. There's no need necessarily to hike again. We're not eager to hike again, but we're not worried about where things are. We're not worried about the labor market. This is clearly a strong labor market. The unemployment rate went down, participation rate went up. That's a good thing. You know, more people coming into the labor market, stronger wage growth, but not too crazy. A pickup in hours worked. So this isn't going to worry them there was some chatter a couple months ago about like a reacceleration in the economy. And I don't think this is going to set off any alarm bells, but it's going to make them feel like, okay, the labor market anyway can withstand the high rates that we have going on right now.
Okay. So all of that said, and with the understanding that, you know, we've seen this before historically, that the Fed, you know, eases off and then inflation picks back up. But as it sits right now, what's left for the Fed to do? This is one of those classic, you know, don't do something, just sit there kind of moments.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it kind of fits with. So the view that Chair Powell expressed recently when he was speaking was this idea that, you know, there have been a lot of benefits on the supply side of the economy, improvements that have helped bring inflation down. And his view that he expressed was that we've kind of seen probably most of the benefits to inflation that we're going to get from that. And it might require some more work on the demand side, which is what the Fed is good at, right? That's what their tools are meant to do, is cool demand to get inflation closer to their 2% target. There are certainly some economists are skeptical of that. They don't think that's necessary, but this is at least the view from the chairman of the Fed. So what does that mean? Rates, you know, are close to, or probably in all likelihood, at their peak. We don't think there are going to be further rate hikes, but what they'll do is they'll hold them there. That's what they've said all along that they intend to do. The big question, of course, is how long are they going to keep them elevated? At this point, rates have been where they at the current level since last July. So it's kind of been a while. while now. And heading into next year, I don't think, you know, markets were kind of starting to think, hey, we might see a rate cut in March. I think that's probably a little premature. We'll find out next week when the Fed releases their own projections, Fed officials, of where they see rates going. But certainly, I think they're going to be comfortable keeping them where they are to try to just keep squeezing. As inflation comes down, that will kind of keep squeezing demand a little bit.
Right. On the theory that when they cut rates, they're going to do it much more gradually than they did on the way up. That is to say, there's not going to be any 0.75 percentage point cut, right, the way they bumped them up on the way up. So my question is, when they cut, it'll be a 0.25 percentage point. Are they cutting for the actual economy, you and me and everybody out there trying to get by? Or will they be cutting for the markets because that's who they think they need to talk to?
That's an interesting question. I haven't really thought about that.
Let's do it live on the radio right now, Kate.
Let's think it through right now. Well, I mean, I think certainly it is ultimately what the Fed does. The Fed would say, of course, like their mandate and what they do is about the real economy.
Right,
I mean,
right.
let's just put that out there, that they would say they're not trying to, you know, their primary concern is not financial markets and they're not really all that worried about them unless they're breaking things or unless things are breaking.
Right.
But I will say about the shape of rate cuts, I do think it matters whether what the timing and sort of the size and the pace of them, it does depend on why they're cutting. And so kind of implicit in your question was that they might be slowly cutting because inflation is coming down. There could be a turn, right? Things could start going south if the economy starts really deteriorating, as some people expect. If there is a downturn or a recession, that could speed things up. I think a lot of what they do, really a more important question than whether or when they cut is really why they're cutting. So right now, it looks like they may start cutting because we are in the soft landing mode and inflation is falling. But that could, you know, that could change quickly.
There's no way for you to know this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What's the monster under Jay Powell's bed right now?
There isn't a way for me to know this, but I think, I think a big question still remains, like consumers, right? This consumer spending and consumer behavior, it's just been so much stronger than anyone anticipated. So I think that a lot depends on that, right? And
right.
as we saw this morning, some really positive, really strong consumer sentiment numbers. Consumers are feeling pretty good, better than they have in a few months. And so that's good, certainly for the White House, for President Biden, who we haven't talked about, and they have a lot riding on what happens to the economy next year. But it could also make them feel better about getting out and spending. So that matters a lot to the economy. I think, you know, Fed officials will always tell you that they'll be the first to say they don't really know where the risk is going to come from. I think there's, you know, slowing in China is a concern. Global growth is a concern. I think some of the market volatility that we've seen is not ideal, but it's not worrying them too much lately. So I don't know that any of those are monsters. He's probably got a few under there.
he probably does. Super quick on the way out, just because you brought him up, and we haven't really talked about him in a while, you and I, or frankly anybody. The White House looks at this number today and says, number one, phew. And then they say, holy cow, what do we think the spring brings, right?
Right. I mean, all along, this White House has kind of been looking at these, I think, these positive jobs reports and being like, yes, but also, what does it mean for Fed policy,
right?
So I think they have fully expected a slowdown, a cooling, a normalization, but and they are still team soft landing, right? Treasury Secretary Yellen.
Yep.
But right, I think they're going to be sort of holding on for dear life from now until the election every jobs Friday, right? I think at this point, it does feel like, okay, inflation, I think in their perspective, is pretty well in hand, right? It's continuing to come down. I don't think there's the same angst about those reports as there will be going forward about the jobs reports in the labor market.
Kate Davidson at Bloomberg, saving our bacon today. Kate, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street on this Jobs Day Friday, big burst of enthusiasm out the gate, and then a stall, and then a long, slow climb into the weekend. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, one more nugget from this morning's jobs report. Looking at one specific part of the labor force, people who are working part-time who want to go full-time but can't or aren't for economic reasons, which is Labor Department speak for business conditions that prevent those people from getting all the hours they want and or need. This month, that number declined by about 300,000 people. So we had Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall untangle what that can tell us about today's job market.
It's been a year of rate hikes and some slowing in the economy. Yet UT Austin's Dan Hammermesh says part-time workers looking for full-time jobs are finding them, with less than 4 million still looking.
This number is now as low as it was a year ago, and it dropped substantially compared to the last 3 months. So this is a very good sign.
It's one of the indicators that makes this a Goldilocks jobs report.
It's not too strong and not too weak. It's just right.
Though part-time employment may not be top of mind for the Fed, Morning Consult economist Jesse Wheeler says it's another green flag.
The share of workers who are part-time for economic reasons right now is historically low at 2.5%. And it's only been that low one other time back in 2001.
He says workers in leisure and hospitality and wholesale and retail trade, who are more likely to be involuntarily part-time, have been finding full-time work. And the Economic Policy Institute's Elise Gold says
that can make a meaningful difference in how much money they have to spend and how they can provide for themselves and their families.
It also can mean people are finding better suited full-time jobs, since part-time work can be a bit of a placeholder while people reassess their careers, says Liz Wilkie with payroll firm Gusto.
If you're part-time but would prefer a full-time job, that doesn't necessarily mean that you'll take any full-time job, right? So part-time workers might be working part-time for something that's fine while they wait, right, for something that's really a good fit.
Though some are forced into part-time work to make ends meet, Ernest Lewis III with Houston Social Services nonprofit Baker Ripley says others are taking part-time jobs
to get their foot in the door in particular career paths and fields as well.
He says in his recent economic development work, he's especially seeing this in retail and banking. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Amazon's got a new grocery subscription it's rolling out, for Prime members, that is. It's coming out in a couple of places across the country for $9.99 a month, on top of what they pay for a Prime membership, by the way. Shoppers in Denver, Sacramento, and Columbus can get unlimited free grocery delivery from either Amazon Fresh or Whole Foods, $35 minimum order. This is the latest in a bunch of changes the company's made to its fresh food businesses as it tries to take yet a bigger bite out of the $800 billion a year grocery market. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Amazon has been in the grocery game since 2007, but it really stepped up efforts in recent years, buying Whole Foods in 2017 and opening Amazon Fresh stores in 2020.
They want to be the everything store, and you can't be the everything store if you don't sell the goods that people buy most frequently, someplace that you'll turn maybe every single day.
Jason Del Rey is the author of Winner Sells All, Amazon, Walmart, and the Battle for Our Wallets. And he says on the grocery front, Amazon does not have the upper hand.
It kind of sounds like a hot mess.
And not the delicious kind. The company has opened and then closed brick-and-mortar stores, switched around the order size that qualifies for free deliveries, offered groceries for a fee to non-Prime members.
And yet, here we are, the end of 2023, and they're really still searching.
Amazon's share of the total grocery market is in the single digits, but buying food online did get supercharged by the pandemic, says Jake Dollarhide, CEO of Longbow Asset Management, who's still in the habit.
I placed an order to have some blackberries and blueberries and meat delivered here to our home, and it's a game changer.
But Dollarhide ordered from Walmart, which leads both online orders and the entire grocery market in the U.S.
Walmart is going to own the value proposition every day of the week, twice on Sunday.
While Amazon, like Walmart, has the benefit of scale, it doesn't, at the moment, have thousands of local stores. And it's hard to make it in the grocery business on deliveries alone, says Phil Lempert, editor of Supermarket Guru. He says even Instacart relies on advertising in its app to stay afloat.
Consumers, for the most part, are not willing to pay the price for delivery. Nobody makes money on it. It's more of a convenience. It's more of a way to build a relationship with people.
He says typical grocery margins are just 1.5%. So it takes a very successful grocery business to maintain a semi-successful delivery business. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Hey, I don't know if you've heard, but if you miss something on the actual radio, you can get us on a podcast. Platform of choice, marketplace.org, however you like. Coming up.
We have seen a huge push of retirees coming back into the workforce.
Yeah, looking forward to that second retirement, I'll bet. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, on this Friday, the Dow Industrials picked up 130 points, 0.4%, closed at 36,247. The NASDAQ up 63 points, almost 0.5%, 14,403. The S&P 500 inched up 18 points, that is 0.4%, 46.4 there. For the week, the Dow almost completely flat. The NASDAQ increased 0.7%. The S&P 500 added 0.2%. Megan McCarty-Carino was just telling us about the state of grocery delivery with Amazon doing what it is going to do. Amazon shares up 0.4% today. Instacart climbed 3%. Walmart and Kroger, also big players in the grocery delivery world. Walmart down 1%. Kroger off about 0.5%. Starbucks said it's going to resume talks with union leaders in January. It's been about 2 years since some baristas started organizing for a contract. Employees have since voted to unionize at more than 370 locations of that coffee store. Starbucks shares frothed up about 0.2% today. Bond prices went down. The yield on the 10-year T-note, in a rare move the last 10 days, 2 weeks or so, up 4.22%. You're listening to Marketplace. You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. President Biden's on a West Coast swing, Los Angeles this weekend for some fundraising and campaign work. A stop today, though, in Las Vegas, where, among other things, there's going to be an announcement of more than $8 billion for passenger rail projects across the country, among them a high-speed line between Vegas and Southern California. High-speed rail has been getting a whole lot of love globally as a climate-saving alternative to flying. There are thousands of miles of HSR crisscrossing Europe and Asia. Stateside, though, outside the rail-friendly Northeast Corridor, not really so much. We asked Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes to find out why.
Rick Harnish sounds almost reverent when he talks about high-speed rail. Makes sense. He leads the High-Speed Rail Alliance, an advocacy group.
Today in China, you could go the distance of Chicago to New York in 4.5 hours.
That's about 700 miles. And if you take Amtrak between those cities, the journey will be at least 5 times as long. One reason trains can't zip along that route is that in most of the country, Amtrak doesn't own the actual track. Robert Puentes leads the Eno Center for Transportation.
It's mostly owned by the freight rail companies who have their own businesses to run, have their own freight to deliver.
And who require passenger trains to share their tracks with freight trains, which are decidedly not high speed. Puentes says in order to have high speed passenger rail, we need to build dedicated track for it. And that's not really something we're used to doing.
We don't necessarily have the workforce. We don't have the project managers. We don't have the political apparatus, right? So all that kind of has to be done from scratch.
It's also incredibly expensive. Take the line that's aiming to connect Los Angeles and San Francisco. It'll involve tunneling through mountains. The Urban Institute's Yona Freemark says, yeah, the project received more than $3 billion this week from the feds.
Which may sound like a lot of money, but the project as a whole to connect Los Angeles and San Francisco is going to cost more than $100 billion to build. So this is just, frankly, a drop in the bucket when it comes to the overall project costs.
And it's not clear where all of that money is going to come from. Freemark says another challenge is that getting those rail lines from planning to completion requires decades of political will.
In order to ensure that projects that we're planning now actually get built, you need to have political consensus in favor of these investments over time.
He says it's not enough to have presidents and governors in favor of high-speed trains today. They need to be in favor for many administrations into the future. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
The holiday shopping season is a complicated economic beast where the variables abound. What consumers are in the mood to buy, how much we go out to celebrate, how much we spend, and whether that's in a store or online. And for companies, how much inventory should they hold? What promotions or specials are they going to have to offer to get us in the door? And how much seasonal help they ought to hire to be ready for all that hoped-for extra business that they are going to do? Because in what is still, even as things slow a bit, dare I say get boring, this is a pretty tight job market, and predicting the demand for holiday labor can be tricky, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Will 80 Brewhouse is a popular bar and restaurant in downtown Olympia, Washington, a state capital and college town. Tuesday's trivia night, Wednesday there's bingo, Thursday discount cocktails. Owner Chris Knudsen says business dips heading into early fall, then bounces back with family gatherings, workplace parties, and the like.
We're definitely picking up, and usually it's pretty busy post-Thanksgiving through the holidays and then the new year.
I've been talking to Knudsen since the post-pandemic boom packed the place a couple years ago.
We're a little bit down this year from where we were last year, but not a ton, maybe 5% or so.
He also says while the labor market's still pretty tight, it's not as hard to hire kitchen and wait staff now.
We aren't scrambling every day to try and find somebody to fill a shift. We do have some college kids that will come back and work for us through the holidays because they're on break. Overall, we're doing okay, and we're having to, like, you know, pinch a little bit with labor and just make sure we're being wise with that sort of thing.
That sense of caution characterizes the holiday seasonal labor market nationwide. Jared Doyle is a senior VP at staffing and recruitment firm Manpower Group.
Hiring demand decreased in all selected functions in November, down this year so far compared to last year. That's across retail, hospitality.
Both sectors were down about 10% from January to November compared to 2022. But Doyle thinks companies are also hiring smarter this year.
Hiring much earlier. We saw that in Q2 into Q3. It still is taking, you know, far longer to fill roles than it did pre-pandemic. And so companies are not waiting for, you know, last minute.
But they have been waiting for consumers to reveal themselves and show how eager they are to shop and spend, says Andy Challenger at outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas, which tracks seasonal hiring.
Every signal that we got coming into the season was just uncertainty, uncertainty, uncertainty from retailers. They really did not know what was going to happen.
As a result, they didn't rush to ramp up their holiday hiring. Challenger says in October, retail hiring was up 3% from a year ago, but warehouse and transportation hiring was down 27%. And major retailers announced the lowest hiring plans in a decade.
We saw so few announcements from companies coming into the season because they were so uncertain. It may indicate what that experience is going to be like for consumers if they're going to be spending long times in lines for stores that are understaffed to get presents delivered on time.
Meanwhile, it's not proving quite as financially challenging to hire workers this year, says Haley Dam, VP of Midwest Operations at staffing agency Adecco.
Last year around this time, there was a huge run on the wage, right? And it was the only thing we were talking about.
Dam, who started with the firm a decade ago as a temp, says this year job seekers want more than just higher wages.
We do have a group of seasonal employees come back to us year after year. Although being competitive in your wage is important, they want to see things like accessibility to benefits. Are they getting a full-time schedule even?
Dam says in the past, older workers and retirees were a crucial component of the temporary seasonal workforce, allowing retailers to staff up for the holiday rush. She says that well dried up in the pandemic.
Many of them did capitalize on some of those early retirement opportunities or simply did not feel safe going to work at the time. And now that we're a little more stable, we have seen a huge push of retirees coming back into the workforce.
While workers 55 and older still haven't returned to their pre-pandemic level of labor force participation, they are slowly catching up. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a day late on this one, but it's important, so I wanted to make sure that we did get back to it. You might have seen on Wednesday, I think it was, the National Retail Federation retracted a claim it made earlier this year that organized retail crime accounted for nearly half of all shrinkage, that is, inventory losses, whatever the reason. You remember all those big retailers closing stores, listing organized theft among the reasons? Well, back in September, we had Nicole Lewis from the Marshall Project on to talk about retail theft and what the data actually says.
What I found was that the main information that we have about retail theft ostensibly increasing actually comes from a lobbyist company, right? A retail lobbying firm that says retail crime is up. It costs us $90 billion a year. It's a big issue and we need sort of stiffer sentences in order to deal with it. But when I dug deep into their report, what I found was that retail theft, by their own accounting, has remained stable from 2016 to about 2022. So even their own numbers don't give us a sense that the problem is increasing.
Nicole Lewis there on this program back in September. She's from the Marshall Project. And with that, farewell. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.